From the University of Central Florida's Center for Distributed Learning, I'm Kelvin Thompson.
And I'm Tom Cavanaugh.
And you're listening to TopCast, the Teaching Online podcast. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Kelvin. That's my favorite podcast.
Is it?
Yeah.
Mine too. That's amazing.
What are the odds?
At least 2-2? I don't know.
I guess, yeah.
I was a music major. I don't really know how that works.
All right. So it's great to be back for yet another scintillating conversation about the latest events in online and higher education.
It is, truly.
And almost as scintillating as whatever's brewing in the pot.
Ooh, that's good.
So why don't you tell us what's in the thermos today?
No thermos today, Tom.
What?
I know. Well, as you say, thematically selected coffee. So dig this, right? So I went to my neighborhood grocery store and literally purchased the least expensive of the, you know, I got the standards, of the better coffee they had on the shelf. There was a sale on, so it happened to be Seattle's best level 4. So after the sale, 40 cents an ounce. I never calculated this before. 40 cents an ounce compared to the 75 cents to a dollar per ounce that I typically pay for higher end coffees. So then I just used one of the office coffee makers to brew up this pot of coffee.
I'm looking at the pot right now. I can vouch for the pot. It is a lovely carafe of 10-cup carafe glass.
That's
that
right.
You might see in your average coffee maker.
So take a look.
Coffee maker.
True disclosure, I don't really use drip coffee makers. I hope I made the coffee right. So what do you think of this stuff?
You know what? After drinking coffee with you for a few months, it's fine.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't have quite the panache of some of your other coffees.
It's panacheless coffee. That's
yeah,
good.
I mean, I'm not criticizing
it. Yeah, right. And so there you go, right? So cost is indeed one of the elements that's important to people, not just with coffee, but in higher education as well. And as we've discussed before, some use the concept of the iron triangle to talk about the relationship between cost and quality and access. And while today's coffee was less expensive than usual, and it was much more accessible at the local grocery store than getting a pound of fresh roasted single origin coffee straight from the roaster, some might argue that the quality has suffered at least a little bit. No offense to Seattle's Best, just,
right.
You know.
Which I'm a fan of. I will drink.
Yeah, me too. So maybe there's a connection to today's episode in there somewhere.
Having to do with cost, you say?
Yeah.
Well, if I recall from a previous podcast, we did say that the iron triangle of quality, cost, and access would be a recurring theme.
It is.
Over the coming months.
It has been.
And look.
It will be.
It seems to have recurred.
That's right.
Here it
right
is.
Here.
Yeah. So cost.
Cost.
Today we're going to talk about cost through the framework, through the lens of the iron triangle.
Are we in favor of it increasing or decreasing?
I am in favor of decreasing costs to students.
I'll vote for you, Tom.
Yes.
I'll vote for you.
How could you not?
That is true.
Apple pie and
something.
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 A chicken in every pot.
So in today's episode, we're going to explore one way of breaking the iron triangle, or at least bending it a little bit, through taking on textbook costs, right? So I think that's kind of cool. So you interviewed Dr. Karen Vignari from the University of Maryland University College back during the 2015 Online Learning Consortium International Conference.
I did.
Karen serves as a vice provost for the Center for Innovation and Learning and Student Success. And some of our listeners might be aware that UMUC has been in the news some because they've been going textbook free as an institution. To a large extent, Karen is responsible for advancing innovation and online education at UMUC. And one area, again, is through this whole textbook free thing. Although she's not directly leading that initiative, she leads other initiatives, and
right.
So she could speak to all this. So I thought this was good. So we're going to cut to the recording of that interview, and then we'll be back in just a little bit to wrap things up afterwards.
So Karen, I'd like to talk about one of the innovations that I know UMUC is really involved with, which has to do with open educational resources. I was really impressed when I read about UMUC's initiative to essentially eliminate all textbooks to help student costs, student affordability issues, and I imagine that's one aspect of it, but another aspect is probably effectiveness as well, as opposed to maybe some of the data that comes out of students' use of textbook materials. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the impetus behind this project and some of the goals you're hoping to accomplish by basically eliminating textbooks in favor of open educational resources.
Yeah, so in 2013, President Mieres basically challenged the university that he wanted to have no cost materials. He wasn't definitive about whether they were open access, whether we were buying materials, and therefore we would own them, or whether we were creating them. But he challenged us to have it completed in 2 years for the undergraduate school and in 3 years for the graduate school. We met the challenge in less than 2 years' time. So by August of this year, 2015, all of our undergraduate schools have no cost for students.
So that doesn't mean, though, if I could jump in, that it's no cost to the university.
Is correct. That correct? And most of the cost to the university was getting there, right? We are not. At this point, we found enough, or we have enough of our own created materials that replace textbooks. And we still consider this version one. And when we talk about version one, basically we replace the textbook, right? Now the opportunity is really around laying the groundwork so that the resources we have are much more tied to the assessments. And that's a version two. Like, mm-hmm. This is not over for us, even though we met the initial deadline. And I should share, like, the biggest news of all is the total cost savings to our students in the undergraduate school was $5 million last year alone.
Wow. Yeah, I totally believe that.
Yeah. And I know that Creative Commons is asking for a forecast for next year. I would assume it'll be similar. We have decreased our course inventory as well during this time because being a large-scale university, what we did is we noticed that, you know, certain courses under, you know, probably 150 students per year probably were not needed by our students. So we did eliminate some course inventory too.
Sure. Could you share some of the strategies you used to get to that goal? OER, licensed materials, purchased materials on behalf of students. What were some of the different arrows in the quiver to kind of get to that goal?
So, I do have to give a lot of credit to the Vice Provost of the Faculty and Learner Experience. Her team includes the course design. That's Dr. Kara Van Dam. And they were really the project managers for this. They worked directly with the undergraduate school, and in our university we call our department chairs program directors. So they worked with our program directors, and they created a committee which included project management. And so that committee, which also included the library, went out and the SMEs identified what do we have already, because we've been in the online business for 15 years. So thus we have some in-house materials already, which we own. And then we went to survey pretty much the open repositories of the world. And in most cases, those are fully Creative Commons licensed materials. But we were also willing, because of no cost, to actually use open access materials as well. We actually did not buy that many licensed materials. So we are using primarily open access and OER materials.
You said something that was interesting because it resonates with something we're working on at UCF, which is trying to identify materials that students are buying that the library already owns so that they could potentially be accessing it at no cost because the university has already borne that cost. But we haven't done a good job of tracking it. Did you find those kinds of overlaps in your initial implementation?
So when we were trying to really get this off the ground, that's the first place we went running to the library. And our library had a license for e-textbooks. And we actually found that the e-textbooks were an okay immediate choice, but as we continued to develop those courses, what we found is the e-text often limited our ability to do a better job at aligning materials to outcomes. And in other words, we replaced one textbook with another one instead of having resources that are really targeted to the outcomes of the course.
Yeah, yeah.
So the library is a really good place because it does start, and then your faculty will be incredibly talented, and they'll be able to find additional materials to build around that. But for us, while we did go to e-textbooks first, we sort of jumped out of them immediately.
I see. And I can see how that evolution would occur. So I'm going to ask a question you probably can't answer. So be prepared for an unfair question. But I have heard some statistics that students who are required to purchase textbooks actually don't succeed at as high a level as students who might use open access materials. And it's primarily because many students just don't buy them. Whether it's for financial reasons or they don't see the value in it or they think they can get away without it. But in many cases, it's financial. They just don't buy the books, and it's going to be awfully hard to succeed in the course if you don't buy the books. So if it's open access materials, they have all the resources that they're supposed to have. You know, the question is, have you seen that kind of an improvement in student success? And if it's too early for that, is that one of the motivators? Is that something that's driving some of this?
It was one of the motivators. Like, we also had the hypothesis that a good 40% of our students were not buying or could not get the textbook in time. Mm-hmm. Remember, UMUC is 50% military. So getting, you know, any number of students who are downrange their textbooks in time was always a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And so having open materials for them means they get them right away. We are in the midst of doing our evaluation work. I can tell you that our first analysis of 92 courses, we did 92 sample courses, where there was no significant difference. However, we're looking at that in a time series way. We're also going to be looking at statistics for different populations, like the military population, Pell. We're actually seeing some potential positives. I don't want to say that I can publish that information yet, but it actually looks like it's going to be pretty promising for populations, that they are doing better in both course completion as well as those that might have been Pell eligible. So we're pretty excited about the evaluation work that we're doing. And, you know, as I mean, UCF is a leader in statistical analysis of learning and analytics. And as we looked at our initial results of no statistically significant difference, that means we did no harm and we saved $5 million.
Yeah, you saved a bunch of money for students, right?
There's still a concern, and here's where one of the reasons that the analysis is taking us more time is, like, those people that understand statistics also understand that if you have ends of 90,000 people, you lose some of your statistically significant actual data because of the large populations, right? Like, we can get statistical significance in smaller populations that you can't actually see in larger populations, right? So what we're trying to do is make sure we really cover the bases, and we're working with some outside experts before we release that. But I'd like to say we'll have our first, we've already released the no significant difference total, but we'll have our next segmented analysis available by the end of November.
So you've alluded to some challenges already, but I wonder if you could kind of point to maybe one or two of the biggest obstacles you had to overcome to implement something like this. I'm thinking about our environment, and granted, we're two different kinds of schools, although we do similar things, and I don't think we could get away with just imposing on faculty no more textbooks, because that's something that the faculty have complete autonomy of choosing within some restrictions, obviously. So that, I mean, that would be a challenge we would face, but maybe that wasn't one of yours. I wonder if you could kind of share what were the biggest hurdles you had to overcome to implement a textbook-free OER initiative.
We also had, and rightly so, our program directors were very concerned about quality and student success. I mean, and I think in that way, our faculty and our the people that work at our institutions are the same. They're always concerned about student success. But the challenge for them was sort of seeing the path forward. That is, we had to get, as we all do, we work with those people who were most willing or where we had the most open resources. And as they began to see that faculty actually felt pretty positive about being freed from the book, that was a way of helping them overcome that barrier. I also believe the other barrier, which we haven't fully, like, we have no cost for textbooks, but that our students still have to pay for software and other things, right? And in many cases, software was coupled with books, right?
Right.
So that's a real challenge. I mean, more than 60% of our programs are business and, information and cyber technology. They require software. So there was a huge challenge there. And we're trying to now go back to the drawing board to see if we can't even expand this so that there is absolutely no cost for students in any materials, whether that's software, whether that's, use of and making sure that actual software is the useful one as we move forward. So phase one, version one for us.
Well, maybe the last question I'll ask is perhaps some advice. If somebody's listening to this and they're thinking about doing something similar at their institution, what would be the top one or two or whatever, however much you can think of here on the spot, pieces of advice you would give to them? Start with this or don't do that, or, you know, what would guide them on their way?
So I'm really hopeful that our research, to be quite frank, will be pretty powerful to people. And I know people are anxious to see it, but we just want to make sure we do it right. And the reason I'm saying start with the research, quite frankly, there is no research that tells us textbooks help student success. It just doesn't exist. And we have to challenge ourselves to actually believe that. And if we can show in our research that our students have performed with or without the textbooks, I think that's going to be a big hurdle that we have to come. So while that's not what institutions should think about, I think the point that they should definitely think about is, particularly depending upon the institutions, I mean, the students you serve should be the most important part of adopting this kind of strategy, right? So I would hope that community colleges, public universities, those that are serving, you know, lower socioeconomic populations are thinking about this first. Mm-hmm. We need to lower the barriers for them. And then I think as an internal strategy, even if everyone agrees on the surface level of that, an internal strategy is still to find the biggest champions. I mean, you know, and we've done this in online learning forever, is work with those people who totally get this, frees them up. They don't have to design a syllabus that meets a book anymore. Instead,
and that,
they design.
And that changes in a year that you have to totally redesign. Right.
Exactly. So look for those champions. But I do hope, you know, what we're able to share, and I think the open community is now sort of heading in this direction, and that's called, you know, it's really open education versus open resources, right? Like the philosophy is now that we don't want to think about this as a course, as a textbook replacement, but the opportunity to redesign a class. You have outcomes that you want them to achieve. Stop starting with the textbook as the way to achieve those outcomes.
I think that's a perfect place to stop. So on behalf of Kelvin, I want to thank you for being on the TopCast, and have fun at the rest of the conference.
Thanks, Tom.
I thought that was a good interview, Tom.
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoy talking to Karen. She's a friend and a colleague, and I think they're doing some really interesting things at UMUC around OER and digital materials to intentionally reduce student costs without impacting quality.
Yeah.
Maybe even improving quality.
Right, without negatively impacting quality.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, exactly. Sure. I think a lot of us are going to be probably watching to see how that textbook-free program goes, just to kind of – they're trailblazers in this area, and it'll – if that sets a precedent, things go well. I have a feeling folks will jump on that bandwagon, you know, try to emulate.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot that many of us could learn from what UMUC is doing right now. And Karen and most of the folks that we know at UMUC are really great about sharing what they've done and what's worked and what's not worked. So I expect to see a lot more at future conferences and in the journals about what's worked and what's not worked and what we can apply at our own institutions going forward.
So do you have thoughts? Can I ask you this? Can put you on the spot, having talked to her. What do you think it will take for other colleges and universities to follow suit with textbook-free initiatives?
Well, you know, it's a good question because every school is different. Mm-hmm. UMUC is a little different than we are.
Yeah, that's true.
And we've got some constraints perhaps that they don't have, and maybe they have some that we don't have. So everybody has their own unique context. But here, for example, I think it would require senior leadership to step in and say, we are doing this, which is, in fact, I believe what happened at UMUC. The president stepped in and said, this is what we're going to do because it's important to us. So I think you need to have very intentional senior leadership willing to make it happen, and not just by fiat, but by investing in the resources and the support materials and ensuring that it's successful. It's not just saying we're going to do it without putting in place the infrastructure to ensure success.
Yeah.
But it has to be intentional. Waiting for it to happen organically, I think, is probably a really long-term kind of a deal.
Yeah, I think that's excellent, right? Because, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but like with the whole OER conversation, right? I suppose one could have a bit of a naive take on this and just think, well, if we just sort of encourage faculty to use OER, this will all spontaneously result in being textbook-free. But I'm sorry, I don't think that would ever happen, right?
Right. And I think faculty in general care about their students' costs, and they know that students sometimes have to really scrape, and sometimes the reason they're not buying the textbook is because they simply can't afford it. Yeah. And that impacts their performance in the course, as Karen alluded to. So, faculty get it. It's just we're dealing with, 1,000 years of certain kinds of models built into higher education practice.
That's right.
And an ecosystem of publishers that make it very easy to just simply sort of adopt commercial materials.
Sure.
So how do you break that that tradition a little bit to think outside the box? It's hard.
And it would need some facilitation, right? I mean, even if you've got an extremely engaged and knowledgeable faculty member, I mean knowledgeable about, say, the OER space and all that, some courses, there's not going to be OER content immediately off the shelf available. And then that can be exhausting to try to create or customize. And then you got to go search for that stuff. And then, those two courses, you were able to find stuff that one you couldn't. And so, is there still a textbook? So, as you said, policies, procedure.
And there have been experiments, interesting things. In fact, one of our sister institutions at the University of Florida, they for a brief period, experimented with actually paying faculty to write textbooks that would be openly available to students. And I think that's a noble endeavor. The problem with those kinds of initiatives is that the sustaining ecosystem of revisions and incentives and compensation for people's hard labor to write a textbook, it's hard to do everything out of the goodness of your heart when you have limited time. So I'm not sure that that is the answer either, to just have institutions pay faculty to write open books.
Yeah. But I think all this sort of really underscores kind of the coolness of what Karen and her colleagues are doing at UMUC.
Absolutely.
The fact that they're actually moving the needle on this, or actually making progress on this initiative is you know, hats off to them. But so I guess maybe, see if this resonates with you. So with this whole theme today, cost isn't everything, but it's not nothing.
It sure matters to students.
That's right. There are many variables we can't control, but maybe with some creative thinking and some good leadership at the top, there are options.
Absolutely. And so, you know, I'm feeling inspired by what Karen and UMUC are doing. And hopefully you are in the listening audience as well.
Absolutely.
So as we kind of wrap up this week's top cast, or this month's top cast.
This year's top cast.
This decade's top cast. We would probably just be remiss if we didn't ask you to go to iTunes, and if you like what you hear, give us a rating and a review. It helps improve the rankings and helps people to find the Topcast podcast if it's the kind of content that they're looking for.
Yeah, that's helpful.
And and our website.
Yeah, so, topcast.online.ucf.edu. Or if you're really old school, just mail a 50 to Tom and Kelvin at UCF. In Orlando, Florida, and we'll get it.
We'll get it.
No, don't do that.
Yeah.
The mail will never reach us.
No, and we'll have to fill out 42 forms.
That's right.
From the state of Florida.
And leave some blood behind. Yeah, it would not be good.
Yeah. Well, so thank you for listening. Until next time, for Topcast, I'm Tom.
I'm Kelvin.
See ya.